Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And we are extremely fortunate today. Our guest is Justice Rebecca Huddle of the Texas Supreme Court. Justice Huddle, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here. So thanks to both of you for inviting me.
Well, we're thrilled to have you here. I imagine the majority of our listeners know who you are, but for those that don't, and maybe those that don't know much about you, can you kind of tell us a little bit about your background, maybe your path to law?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in El Paso, other side of the state from where I practiced law. I grew up in a big family, youngest of five kids. And, you know, our dad died when I was pretty young, five. And so, you know, growing up, much of my life and worldview is shaped by my mom, who was a single mom and faced with that challenge. So I like to tell people she's my hero. So lived there in El Paso my whole life, really, until I went off to college.
Well, one of the things that I thought was interesting was you didn't go straight through to law school. You took a year off and taught Spanish after college. How was that experience?
So really interesting. I loved being a teacher. And for many years, I thought that's what I might do. That might be my forever job. I was not one of these people who knew from, you know, the age of seven that you wanted to be a lawyer. And so I love the experience. I, you know, think it's a pretty good precursor to being a trial lawyer. I mean, there are lots of similarities between the two jobs. You can, you know, analogize your students to jurors in a few different ways. They're not all interested in what you're talking about. Some have more ability to understand what you're talking about than the others. And you're trying to sort of take concepts that are new to them and get them to understand and then trust you and embrace you as you go. So, it, you know, there was some aspect of it that's more like herding cats than you do as a trial lawyer. You don't have to, you know, break up arguments or anything like that. But in lots of respects, it's a good exercise for someone who ends up trying cases.
You think about what it takes to educate a juror about your case, I suppose, and then you can see how the skill set of teaching students what they need to know, what you think they should know, how that would translate well into the courtroom. That's very interesting.
I think so. And so I enjoyed the job very much. I made lots of great friends, my co-teachers, but probably the most memorable experience was in the Bay Area. And probably the most day that sticks out in my head the most is the day that I was standing in front of the class and we had an earthquake. So the classroom just all sort of slid as I stood up in front of it. And that was only one of many reasons I ended up wanting to come back home.
What made you decide to go to law school? Did you kind of have that thought in your head when you started teaching, or did you kind of come to that on your own as you were going through it?
Yeah, I kind of knew by then, by the time I was wrapping up undergrad, that I started working on the LSAT and applying to law school. I thought that was likely where I would end. But, you know, I thought it was pretty valuable to have a job to get up for and get dressed for every day of the year, like a grown-up before I went on to law school. So I thought it was valuable for me. I think, too, you know, now having spent many a year interviewing law students for law firm jobs and court jobs, that it helps grow you, it helps develop you at that point in your life when you're, you know, I don't know, 20, early 20s or something. I think it's a good education to have a full-time job.
Were you one of those that, it doesn't sound like you had a big gap in between undergrad and law school, but did you manage to translate that into being so disciplined in law school that you treated it like a job and really, you know, focused mostly during ordinary working hours and that sort of thing?
Well, I don't know that I did that. It was only a one-year teaching gig. And what I do remember about law school is that I really didn't love studying at home. So it wasn't so much that I was disciplined about when I did the work, and I certainly didn't work 8 to 5, you know, in law school, but I did tend to go to the good old Tarleton Law Library at UT because it's where I would really focus. And maybe also my apartments in law school were not so great, especially 1L. I like being in the law library a little better.
So from law school, you went into practice at Baker Botts. Did you go straight to Baker Botts?
Yeah, I went straight there. Those were the days where you split, you know, and all the law firms allowed you to split. And so I did that. I split at Baker Botts and Vini and ended up feeling like Baker Botts was a good fit for me. And that ended up being true. I started there. Again, it was not like I went in thinking, oh yeah, big law is where I want to end up. It was just more of, you know, like that's who came to OCI at UT. And so those are the interviews I had. And when I got the job, I moved to Houston, started the Baker Botts office, not really knowing, you know, very many people here, of course, a few law school friends, but really came here for the job and not having a significant connection to Houston. So it worked out though.
Did you start doing litigation and appellate? Did you just kind of specialize in one or the other or do a little bit of everything?
Yeah. So it's interesting, Jody. I really, for many years, thought of myself as purely a trial lawyer. And, you know, that, of course, always involves some appellate-like work, dispositive motions and, you know, interlocutory appeals and that kind of stuff I would handle. But this was, you know, a time where people, at least in the firm I was practicing in, there was not a really well-developed specialized group for appellate work. There were a few people who kind of tended to do more of that, but it was very common for people, trial lawyers, to just handle their own appeals. So I did that some, but mostly I really thought of myself as a trial lawyer. But I had a pretty broad practice, I'd say, with, you know, some cases. I worked on some gigantic cases as a young lawyer, many, many middle of the road, kind of typical breach of contract commercial cases. But what was a standout and what I think really, really helped in my development as a lawyer was firm kept this docket of car wreck cases, so a little insurance defense docket. And if you kind of impressed one of the older partners, they would find a way to get you to some of this work. And that is really how I ended up, you know, first being in a position of having to figure out strategy, get in front of a jury, that kind of thing. And so it's sort of unusual to say, but being at Baker Botts, I sort of cut my teeth trying cases on car wreck cases. I mean, some of them were, you know, $5,000 at issue, and I got to go and try them. And so that was just really valuable. And I know it's so hard now and getting harder to get that kind of experience. So I was really lucky. I call that one of the luckiest things that happened to me growing up as a lawyer.
That was pretty common among some of the larger firms in Texas at the time, because I remember this may have been sort of winding down by the time I got to my original firm, Fulbright and Jaworski, but that was always the lure that, you know, you would show up on a Monday morning and pick up the file and go down to the courthouse and try the case. It would have been an amazing way to get trial experience. I mean, I don't know how much strategy you could really implement if you're picking up the file in the morning of trial, but it's what a neat experience. And I assume that's kind of gone away with insurance companies taking most of their work into outside or to dedicated counsel, captive counsel rather.
Yeah. You know, I know there has been some still left that at my firm in particular, but I think it's definitely less than there was, you know, 20 or certainly 30 or 40 years ago, for sure.
It is, though. I mean, it's something that has been kind of an issue for so long, is how do you get young attorneys trial experience, and or even middle of the road and older attorneys now? You know, there are plenty of people that have been practicing 20 and 30 years that just have not had the opportunities to have a lot of civil jury trials because there just aren't that many anymore.
That's right. It's a challenge. I'm not quite sure anyone has figured out how to solve the problem, but it's encouraging to see lots of courts, individual judges, you know, incentivizing the older generations to push those kinds of opportunities down, opportunities for oral advocacy, even if it's, you know, just a motion for summary judgment. I love seeing when judges encourage that and say, if you let the associate argue this, you will get a hearing. I think that's terrific.
Westlaw Edge is the standard for legal research, bringing together a legacy of quality and accurate legal research and the latest advancements in technology. First-of-its-kind features like the next generation of legal search, intelligent document analysis, integrated litigation analytics, and the most powerful citator expedite research tasks that were once incredibly complex and time-consuming. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to deliver the fastest answers and gain the most valuable insights, providing a clear strategic advantage. Be a better attorney, make your firm better, and serve your clients better than you have before with Westlaw Edge.
When did you start kind of thinking about going onto the bench? Was that something you'd always wanted to do?
Well, it was not initially, but my experience there was, again, lucky and unusual. What I had was a situation where, you know, some of the people who were my peers as young lawyers ended up going on the bench themselves. So like take Jeff Brown, for example, formerly of the Supreme Court, now the district court in Galveston, the federal district court. You know, we used to work on some of these insurance defense cases together when we were young lawyers, and he got on the bench very early. And so I saw that, and him being my friend, I got to see, you know, through him and through conversation, what the job was like, what the life was like. I saw that he loved it. You know, same thing with Judge Elrod, who was just a few years ahead of me. I mean, she's someone who'd been, you know, walking around the law firm, and I got to know that way. And so I had, you know, few close contacts like that who I knew were really enjoying it. And that's sort of how I decided I might give it a shot. And so that's a whole other story unto itself. To answer the question about how I thought about going on the bench, again, I really only thought of being a trial judge. At the time, I applied to be appointed to some district courts in Harris County, and just didn't get them.
Well, you mentioned there's a whole other story. I mean, let's not leave that uncovered unless we really need to. I mean, if you want to move on, that's fine. But this is what we want.
That's right. Okay. All right. Well, yeah. Well, that was the beginning of the story. That's how I came to start applying. You know, what I was suggesting was I was really only applying to be a district court judge. That's what I knew. That's where I saw myself. And I applied a few times and, you know, a couple times got interviews and said, you know, was told, thanks for playing. It's not going to be you. And so about the third time that happened, I said to my husband, okay, well, this is fun and all, and this is a great job and I'd love to do it, but there's only so much of this I can take, because each time I get kind of excited, invest a lot of time trying to get ready and get hopes up, and then be told, no, it's not you. And so again, for the third time, I was told, no, sorry, you're not getting this district court bench, but have you considered the appellate court? And that is really the story of, you know, how I got on the appellate bench. And the truth of it was that until that conversation, I really hadn't thought of seeking a spot on an appellate bench. That's how that happened. That was 2011 when I went on the Court of Appeals, the first here in Houston.
Well, it sounds like a couple of things that would come out of that are, one, don't give up after the first try or two tries. And we've heard other judges on the show talk about putting your name in circulation. And even if you don't get it, then down the road, something like what happened to you might happen. And so getting your name in circulation among the people who would be in a position to help you get one of those positions. But the second thought coming out of it is, you know, it's helpful. We like to think as appellate lawyers that it's helpful to have judges with appellate experience, appellate justices rather with appellate experience. And I think that's generally true, but there's also a lot of value in judges with real trial experience on the appellate bench, because there needs to be a mix, right? So I guess you were able to offer that despite your initial desire to be on the district court bench, the trial bench. You brought your litigation experience to the Court of Appeals in Houston.
That's right. And you know, I'd hazard a guess to say lots of folks would agree that it's a good and important to have people with various different kinds of experiences when you are working in groups to decide cases. I mean, there's not always going to be, you know, an expert on every kind of case that comes up. But in general, it's good to have, you know, when we were on the Court of Appeals, some appellate pros, some criminal pros, some folks who had actually, you know, offered evidence and cross-examined a witness when you have a case where that's relevant. And so, yeah, I think it's helpful. And I'm glad that we have that kind of variety. And that's been true both at the Court of Appeals and on the Supreme Court, that there is just kind of there's a whole spectrum of, you know, folks and experiences who all have specialized experience and just understanding of different parts of all the many various kinds of issues we address.
Was there anything about being on the appellate court that kind of surprised you, coming from maybe a trial practice and some appellate background?
Well, I'd say what surprised me is probably what every judge says surprises them, is the amount of work that is actually running through the courts day in and day out. You know, I think I tended to think, I won't project this onto anyone else, but I, as a practicing lawyer, tended to think that being a judge was pretty easy. And in my own head, judges were sort of, you know, having a cocktail at 5 p.m. and that just was wrong thinking.
Had you had any experience with like political campaigning or any of that part of it before you went on the bench?
Not really. I mean, again, I'd seen people I was fairly close to run campaigns, and I'd supported, you know, various judicial candidates, but no, not really. And so that was, you know, a big learning experience, and it's in a steep learning curve is figuring out how to do that. I'll tell you, it's, you know, I thought the first Court of Appeals district, which is a 10 county district here, was pretty big until, you know, a year ago, I realized I was now dealing with 254 counties. That's pretty big.
I can't even imagine, especially, you know, coming into that in the middle of a pandemic on top of everything else, which we'll talk about in a minute. But I can't imagine, you know, going from Houston, then going to 10 counties, then going to the whole state. It just, I bet you realize how massive Texas really is.
Yeah, it's massive. And it just makes you sit and think about, you know, it's 30 million people, 254 counties, 30 million people. And how can you, you know, use your time and resources strategically when you're only one person. You know, there's not a ton of money in judicial races.
This is why the campaign people get paid the big bucks to help you strategize on this very sort of thing, because it has to be a much different animal to think about running a district court campaign and then take that and amplify it by the Court of Appeals district, you know, several dozens of counties in most of our districts, and take that again and multiply it, you know, by the exponential, you know, 254 counties. Now, granted, I assume, you know, you got population centers within those 254 counties, so you kind of know where you're going to spend most of your time. But I don't envy you in that task. And I guess what I'll say is I bet you're very grateful for Southwest Airlines.
We can't ask her to endorse a particular brand, but just...
No, don't. Please don't take it that way.
I'll tell you what I endorse, my own car. I'm putting a lot of miles on my own car.
I'm always surprised to hear that candidates for statewide races use their own cars more than you think, because it just seems like, you know, you equate the time value of money, and you're supposed to get your job. This is the thing too, for people who are listening, who don't have any experience with this, is, you know, you're appointed to a new job on a new court in a new city. And yet you have the privilege to run to try to keep that job in the very next general election, never having run a statewide campaign before. So this is an immense amount of time investment, money investment, and stress, no doubt about it. Are you surviving?
I'm definitely surviving. You know, the first year of anything, I tell people, it's just going to be hard. There's so much to figure out. But, you know, you get there day by day. And, you know, the learning curve is pretty steep in terms of running a campaign. But the work at the court is, you know, work we've been doing, you know, you've been training to do for a couple decades now. Sometime on the bench. And so that, thankfully, was not new. Now, there are lots of things that are different about working on this court versus the Court of Appeals, for sure. That at least was not new. It, you know, to your point, yeah, there are some challenges, especially taking that on in mid-pandemic. On this court, where we're nine working on every case together, the interpersonal dynamic is especially important, I think, to understand where your colleagues are on a case, to really have a vet ideas and have a full-throated conversation. It helps to know the people, and it's, you know, that's a little easier to do, a lot easier, I'd probably say, if you are in person and have an opportunity to just sit there eyeball to eyeball and talk about stuff. So thankfully, we are off of Zoom. And that has gotten better. We went back to in-person conferences in the late spring, and we're now in-person everything, to include argument, as of the beginning of this term. So it's much, much improved from the perspective of someone who's new to the job, new to the institution, new to some of the people. So much better to be able to sit next to someone and talk about it.
How's the transition from being on a court where whatever case came in the door, you had to make a decision on it, to one where you have discretionary review? How's that been?
Well, so fascinating. So I hadn't really ever, you know, thought about how much time we would spend on deciding what to decide. And it really is quite a lot. It's nice to have discretionary review. It means that you know, every case is really interesting, and there really are effectively, you know, no repeats. On the Court of Appeals, there are, especially on the criminal side, lots of issues that tend to come up. That just doesn't happen here. So it is a new challenge, really, in every single case. And so that's, you know, one of the great things about it.
How was it adapting to a court that had criminal jurisdiction, you know, coming from a pretty, I assume, just a strict civil background?
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole new world, right? And so that's true of the criminal docket. And the criminal docket was about 50% of what we did at the Court of Appeals. But there's also other stuff that I'd put in that bucket that was brand new to me. Family law. There's a lot of family law at the Court of Appeals. And I just, you know, never thought about so much of that really important work. So for sure, that was a learning process. You know, I'd never thought about ineffective assistance of counsel, which is a, you know, really prevalent issue at the courts of appeals. So learned a ton on the substantive law and how to be a judge at the Court of Appeals, and how to decide a case as a group, right? That's important too, how you work to get to a majority. And so that is a bigger challenge at the court of here on the Supreme Court, rather. When you're a panel of three, you know, three of us sitting here talking about something, I mean, it's not all that hard to get one of you, you know, to go with me down a certain path to decision. But it's a whole different ballgame when you've got, you know, a big conference table and nine, all really smart, all well prepared. Thoughtful people with strong views of how something ought to go.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond, ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a $1 billion appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today. Well, to close the loop a little, we kind of jumped, maybe because of the way that we've asked the questions, but we kind of jumped from Court of Appeals to Supreme Court. But you had a stopover back at your previous firm between the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. So how did you find going back into private practice off the Court of Appeals? What had changed over the time that you had sat as a justice on the first Court of Appeals?
Well, not all that much had changed. Actually, the practice, you know, hadn't really changed. I went back in 2017, so this was pre-pandemic, and things were not all that different. Lots of folks who'd been my mentors growing up as a lawyer had retired by then, but I'd say that was about the biggest change. In terms of, you know, me, Rebecca, going back, I think being a judge does change by a lot how you look at cases. And I think the best way to describe that is to say that you really approach every case with a forest view and not a tree view. And that is just, you know, something you have to learn to do and learn to do pretty fast on the Court of Appeals. Just given the volume, you've got to, you know, be able to zoom in, but also then really zoom out and really, you know, taught me about being efficient, getting to the point. And those are some things I was able to bring back to practice that, you know, I hadn't really known firsthand is how much judges really do mean it when they say no, really less is more.
It is easy to forget from the practitioner's side because you live with a case, you get to know the record better than pretty much anybody, and you just get so down in the weeds on all of those things. And you forget the context of, hey, when I go argue this case at the Court of Appeals, I will have spent, you know, 20, 30, 40 hours getting ready for oral argument. And the justices have five other cases that day that they've had to get prepared for. And yeah, it's super important to me. And not that it's not important to them, but it's one stack in a very large stack of papers.
Right. And so I guess the moral of that story is it's much better to have a 40-page brief than it is to have a 60-page brief.
Pick your battles carefully.
And not a dozen issues, but rather a couple, maybe three, probably as a rule of thumb.
Does this really matter?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I'm going to throw a sort of unfair question your way just because I always love to hear people's perspectives on this. But if you're in Houston and you have an issue that the first and 14th courts have decided differently, what do you do in the trial court with that?
Yes. I want to know the answer to this too.
Well, I don't know. I guess I look to see what everyone else has said about it. Or, you know, make an argument that one of the two approaches is far superior than the other.
Probably the first court, right?
That's a tricky one for sure. Maybe Justice Huddle would invoke judicial privilege here and say,
yeah, that's totally fair.
As a justice on the Supreme Court, I can't comment on.
No, I wouldn't really ask her to. It's just one of those unique little geographical things that I've always found kind of fascinating that you have two courts deciding the same issues of law in the same jurisdiction, and they don't always agree on things. It's just kind of a funny little wrinkle.
Yeah. Those of us who have a single court jurisdiction, a single appellate court jurisdiction, we bank on the fact if I find a case out of the third court of appeals, I can waive that in front of the trial judge and say, judge, this is the law. Okay. And not having that necessarily in Harris County and the surrounding counties, I guess what we could say, Jody, is maybe it increases opportunities for advocacy among the folks who really need to be able to do that to the court. So it's such a unique situation, really, and a little mind-boggling to the rest of us. But I know the Harris County lawyers are used to it.
I think that's right. I'd like to think that it's not that frequent that happens. Has that happened in your practice?
It happened a couple of times. When I was in law school, I clerked on a state district bench in Houston. And so it happened a couple of times there where an issue would come up where you had two different decisions and the judges essentially just had to pick one and hope it got docketed in the right court when it went up on appeal.
I think I've had a situation where a trial judge in Houston said, yeah, that's the first court of appeals. So it just didn't carry as much weight, only having a case from one of the courts as opposed to being here. But so on that same, this is not an unfair question, I don't think, but I want to get back to you, what you were saying about, you know, your early experiences applying for appointment to the bench. You had some time back in private practice and you rose, I believe, to the managing partner of the office, the Houston office of Baker Botts. So this was a pretty good gig you had by all accounts. So I assume that you yet sought appointment to the Supreme Court of Texas. And if that assumption is correct, then I guess it turned out okay for you this time.
Well, absolutely, it's turned out okay. But I'll tell you the story of how this appointment happened. It was COVID, you know, fall of last year. And I, of all things, no one was in the office at that point. Just no one. It was no man's land. But I was in the office one evening because as the partner in charge, we call it the PIC. PIC, partner in charge of, as the PIC of the Houston office, I had a presentation to give to management the next, you know, two days later. And so I was there, it was a Tuesday night, and it was dinner time, you know, it was like 7 o'clock or something. So it was odd that I would have been there and there was no one else in the office. And my landline rang. I said, who in the world is calling me here? And no one's in the office. And it was someone calling from the governor's office asking, certainly I knew about the appointment and what I'd be willing to, about the vacancy rather, and what I'd be interested in considering the Court of Appeals. No, I'm sorry, the Supreme Court. And so that is how that happened. I was not looking to leave the firm. I, you know, as you say, Todd had a pretty good gig. I'd settled back in there. I'd had the trust of my partners and was working with many old friends that I'd known my whole career. And so it was a surprise to me and not something that I'd planned for. But I'll tell you, one of the things I thought about at my husband's suggestion was, you know, on your deathbed, Rebecca, will you be glad that you jumped on this opportunity or not? So answer to that was absolutely yes. But also, you know, I told you, we started off talking at the beginning of the hour about growing up. And so that really was a big part of the decision for me. I mean, I got to go to the schools I did, undergrad and law school, on scholarships. That was due to the, you know, generosity of other people. And so I really felt like I had a duty. This was an opportunity to serve and give back and do something for our community. And so I wanted to jump on that.
Well, I stand corrected. And I'm happy to be, honestly. In my experience, there are folks who actively seek those appointments in the rare instances when they come up. But what an honor for you to be contacted by the governor's office. And yes, that did turn out pretty well for you, even though you had a pretty good gig. So what an interesting and wonderful story as far as how you got to the Supreme Court. And now, of course, you're in the throes of campaigning at the tail end of a pandemic. But getting appointed in a pandemic had to be a challenge in and of itself. You were running the Baker Botts Houston office as the PIC. And next thing you know, you're going to retake the bench, this time on the Supreme Court, also during a pandemic. How was that?
Well, sort of nuts, as you can imagine. The court was, for the most part, working all remotely. And so it was, you know, a situation where if I wanted to go to the courthouse and pick up my computer initially, get a badge to get in the front door. All of that had to be, you know, set up because most people were not working from there. So it was, you know, as everyone has experienced, you know, not real convenient to try to do business as normal during a pandemic. But we got it all done because the staff talk about a committed staff at the Supreme Court are all just, you know, working round the clock weekends to try to make sure everything is going as it should. And so we all, through lots of effort, just made the best of it, got me set up to work remotely. And mostly it was just a question of digging in and doing the reading and getting up to speed, which is hard regardless of whether there's a global pandemic. But thankfully, some of the things are the same. So the database at the Supreme Court is the same as that used in the Court of Appeals, the same document management system. And so some of that, so I wasn't learning everything from scratch, is my point. It was a lot to learn, but some things I had a head start on.
How was it, having done in-person oral arguments on the Court of Appeals, how was it transitioning to virtual oral arguments as a justice on the Supreme Court?
Well, I'll tell you, the biggest, starkest difference is the number of arguments that happen in a compressed period of time. At the Court of Appeals, we argued every week, but a much smaller number of cases got argued in a week. It might be two or three in a week. But now here, as you know, we argue nine in a setting, three each day, three back-to-back days. So that is a big change and just requires a whole different kind of strategy for getting prepared and process for getting prepared. And then, you know, doing it on Zoom, it's initially awkward, just like we all experienced Zoom awkwardness. But again, thanks to Blake, the clerk, and lots of preparation and all of the advocates coming in early to do the work, to get ready, to go through the practice procedures, I think it was incredibly smooth overall.
Are you happy to be back in person, though?
Oh, nothing beats, as I said, nothing beats sitting down with a colleague, across the table from each other and having a conversation about the case. Nothing beats that.
Well, and especially at the Texas Supreme Court, you know, you were talking earlier about the size of the state, and it just kind of clicked with me how important it is for the Supreme Court to get it right, because the impact of your decisions goes so many different places and affects so many different people. So I bet it really is nice to have that in-person, face-to-face conference time.
Yeah, it's also just fun. You know, we don't always see everything the same way, but it's I think the chief really sets the tone for, you know, the fact that we're going to have a conversation that is a respectful conversation, regardless of how we see the case. And that, you know, is always true. It's always respectful, even if we are, you know, have polar opposite views of an issue. And, you know, that makes good sense, because we have to, once we get past that case where we might disagree, we've got, you know, 100 other more cases to talk about, sometimes in that very same conference in that very same day. And so you've just got to figure out how you're going to hammer through all of that together.
I know, you know, oral argument days can be long, but I know conference days can be long too, and maybe even longer. I know those agendas are really long. You've got a lot to get through, and you're not conferencing as often as you're having oral argument. So we get the privilege of taking a peek at the court's calendar online, and we know when conferences are going on. So it's always with interest that we watch those next sets of orders, of course, after conference.
Interest, anxiety, you know, curiosity, yeah. a lot of different emotions.
Absolutely. Would you tell us sort of what your typical day would be like? Let's say, you know, I take it you're probably splitting time between Houston and Austin, which is not unusual for a justice from another city to not necessarily pick everything up and come to Austin. But fortunately, through technology, you know, you have the ability to be virtually there even when you're in Houston. But what does a typical day look like, let's say, you know, during a conference week?
Well, good question. And I'm glad you kind of put it as you did, because other than conference week or argument week, there really is no typical day. Those do absolutely have a really set, you know, schedule on those weeks. So conference, you know, this coming conference, we actually have a happy conference coming up, or I say, celebratory conference coming up because we're going to have the court photo taken with the new justice, Evan Young, next week. So that's kind of that's fun. And we're glad to have him aboard and eager for him to come on and get to work. But so conference, you know, as you say, Todd, can be a grueling day. We kick it off at 9, work to a good stopping point, have a short lunch break, come back, continue with the law work. And that might go on, just depending on what the agenda looks like, might go on through mid-afternoon, might go late afternoon. And then you may know, then we take up the administrative part of the conference, which may be another, you know, couple of hours, depending on, again, what the agenda looks like. So it is a long day, and it's, you know, getting to the point that, and that's just the day where we're there talking about it, the getting ready for conference is, as you know, big chunk of work, long multi-day process.
I think a lot of lawyers don't think about the administrative load that the Texas Supreme Court carries. And it's good of you to mention that administrative conference requires that same kind of time. It may not be the bulk of your time in a conference on a conference day, but you know, there are at any time a number of significant administrative issues pending before the court. I mean, think about what are we up to now? 40 something emergency orders. I mean, there had to be, I'm sure, some level of conferencing on those. The day-to-day operation of the legal system in Texas. But to that point, I wanted to ask you, when we've had Supreme Court justices on before, we wanted to make sure and give them a chance to talk about their liaison assignments. And so what assignments do you have in that capacity?
Yeah, so both are pretty new. And the chief sort of redistributes assignments at the beginning of the term. And being the new judge last year, I think the philosophy is you got to give the new judge a little time to just, you know, figure out the law work before you pile assignments onto them. Or at least that's what happened in my case. But so starting this term, I'm the deputy liaison to two commissions I'm really excited about. One's the Children's Commission, and the other is the Commission on Mental Health. So two really important, you know, bodies doing really, really great work on very serious problems, kind of the intersection of those social issues with the judicial system. So really, those are staffed by wonderful staff. I get to sort of share the work on the Children's Commission with Justice Lehrman. On the Mental Health Commission, I share the duties with Justice Bland. And so we're off to a great start. But, you know, to your point, I myself was not aware of how much time and work all of these other you know, kind of non-law, not related to case assignments are out there. And it's a significant part of, you know, any judge's time.
I feel like that must be one of the harder parts of the job to kind of educate the public on that, because I think so few people really know what the Texas Supreme Court does in general. But then on top of that, it's sort of like you are literally in sort of a granite box down there by the Capitol, and nobody really sees what goes on day to day or realizes all that goes into keeping the Texas court system running every day.
Right. I mean, the good thing about it is that there are so many members of the bar staff on these important organizations that are doing the kind of day-to-day work. And so we're appreciative of that. But you're absolutely right. I mean, there's a Supreme Court Advisory Commission. There's the Rules Committee. There's all these groups of people working really, really hard to give input and ideas about all the varied things that the Supreme Court oversees. So it's a team effort for sure, but yeah, I think you're right. Most people don't really understand the breadth of what all is going on and what we look at, month to month.
One topic, kind of switching subjects a little bit, that I know you're passionate about that I wanted to give you a chance to talk about was mentoring in the law.
Yeah, I love meeting and talking to young lawyers. It's one of the things I loved in practice as I, you know, got more senior was helping, I guess, this may be that I am at my very core a teacher, sort of I like being in that role. But that was one of my favorite parts of being in practice was, you know, hiring on new associates, sort of bringing them into the fold, getting them to feel like, especially women, getting them to feel like they had a place there, they could do this hard work. And, you know, in some respects, in some corners of the world, you know, I wanted to play that role for especially young women lawyers, because as I came on and grew up as a lawyer, there were not all that many women lawyers, you know, in senior roles at firms. But the ones who were there did that for me. And so, again, it's about paying it forward. And you know, the law, the business of practicing law is hard baseline. And so that's hard for everybody. And, you know, I just think that something we all do, we're all grateful that people did it for us. And so it's just about kind of helping the next crop of young lawyers as they come up through the ranks. So I enjoyed that. I think that's one of the perks of growing up as a lawyer is teaching the next gen. And that same thing is true at the court. At both courts, I really enjoyed being in a position to help introduce young lawyers to the practice and the profession.
And I bet it's fun to be able to pick a couple of law clerks every year to bring along in that process too.
It's really fun. We've got a really wide variety, a wide cast of characters. And, you know, for as far as I'm concerned, I really like strong writers. But I also like to look for interesting people in the stack of resumes that come through. And so that's the joy of the job, is getting to pick the next year's crop, you know, eager clerks, and, you know, welcome them to the profession. It's a joy.
What's the timeline for y'all making your hiring decisions for people that might want to do a Supreme Court clerkship?
It's a great question. And it really is ongoing. And so I would say, you know, I would not think to myself, if I'm interested, that it's too late. I mean, it happens all the time that someone's clerk, you know, got married and decided to move somewhere else. And so they're looking for someone to start, you know, next fall, but that's only 2 months away. I mean, there are just lots of, you know, things, unexpected things that happen. And so I would just send it in no matter what time it is. But of course, earlier is better. If you're a 1L or a 2L, I'd do it as early as you can, because some judges hire for years in advance. But it also happens, especially with new judges, that they haven't done the hiring even for, you know, next fall. So I'd encourage people to apply regardless of when you first started thinking about it.
And experienced lawyers too, for staff attorney positions. We just got word that Justice Young is looking for a staff attorney. So those who are interested in working for the Texas Supreme Court, you don't have to be just on the cusp of coming out of law school. There are great jobs. They're working directly with the justices. So that's something else to keep in mind. And be a great way to get, if you don't already have experience on the appellate side. Imagine that's something that the court looks for. But if you don't have a ton and want to get more, it'd be a great opportunity for somebody.
That's right. I would hop on it. As you know, those don't come open all that often. It's really an amazing thing to observe, but it's really true that folks who get those jobs don't tend to leave them, because it's a really good, really interesting, with a bunch of really great people. So yeah, that word out. It's a great job.
Well, Justice Huddle, you've been so gracious with your time, and we really appreciate the chance to visit with you today. We are coming to the end of, we mentioned the hour. We're not quite there, but it's we're a little past where we might ordinarily go, but we've enjoyed hearing from you and hearing your stories, your experiences. We want to give you the chance that we give every other guest, which is the opportunity to kind of wrap up with a tip or a war story that you'd offer to our listeners.
Yeah, so I'm going to go and hit you with something just really basic that I think, you know, it's easy to forget in the world we live in today, and especially in law practice, where we have, you know, deadlines, we have high stakes, we have stress. You know, that's what I tell younger people too. At the end of the day, it's gonna matter most, I think, at the end of the day, just how you treated people. And so I just, you know, remind people, even when you lose, even when something goes wrong. I mean, I just try to say, pick yourself up and try to be kind to people.
That's great advice. And both in person and in the way you write to the courts about parties and opposing counsel and everything else. I'm sure you have seen quite a few of those briefs that don't take that into consideration.
That's right. And what I'd say, at having been on this side of the bench, is, you know, people, lawyers sort of hear that. And I heard that as a lawyer, and I thought, oh, that's just sort of a cliche that every judge says, don't attack the other side unnecessarily or overly harshly. But it's more than a cliche. You know, as I said, there's just a lot of cases running through every judge's desk every year. And it's just kind of an annoying distraction of, you know, that 99 times out of 100 is just not at all necessary. So it probably is not going to go over well. I just leave those out at the risk of sounding cliche.
Not at all. I see it enough in my own practice where it needs to be said again and again. So I'm glad that you do reiterate that.
Agree 100% on that. Well, thank you again, Justice Huddle, for being with us.
So grateful.
Yeah, I've been really pleased to visit with you. Thanks for having me on. I'll look forward to listening to our episode and your other episodes. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.